a quote from Weinberg's book, The Quantum Theory of Fields, mainly to advertise this book to you as a good reference. I think, I don't remember, but it's some of the first chapters of volume one that you might find relevant to what we will be doing today. The book goes a lot further. It's a very good book. So since we have been talking about symmetry transformations, I just wanted to quote this. A symmetry transformation in quantum mechanics is a change in our point of view that does not change the results of possible experiments. So this is why we are studying groups that represent symmetry transformations. So let's see what we have done. Oh, I should have asked, are there any questions from yesterday's lecture? Awesome. So what have we seen so far? Yesterday, we saw that rotations in three-dimensional Euclidean space are described by the group O3. And we may want to constrain this symmetry further. But I should say that rotations are O3. It is up to us to make a choice to actually work with matrices that have determinant plus one, and this gives us the group SO3. If we are working in higher dimensions, we similarly have ON and SON. So this is what we did yesterday. Today we're going to do two more things. We're going to study rotations in Hilbert space. And these are described by special unitary matrices. And we will also do rotations in four-dimensional Minkowski space, and this will be the group SO3,1. We'll see what these things are. So let's start with quantum mechanics. We work with a Hilbert space. The Hilbert space is a complex space, whereas Euclidean space was a real space. We denote, again, our vectors by psi. And under a unitary transformation, psi goes to u psi. And as we've said, if we want to present to preserve probabilities, in other words, if we demand that psi, scalar product psi psi, is exactly the same, after we've done the transformation, then U has to be a unitary matrix. So UN gives us the group of n by n unitary matrices. And if we further demand that the determinant of U is plus one, we have the group of special unitary transformations. Now, they preserve?
Don't anti-unitary matrices preserve norms?
So anti-unitary matrices also preserve norms. But it's a similar choice to work with unitary instead of anti-unitary matrices. Okay, so maybe I should say this. There is a theorem that says that symmetry transformations in quantum mechanics have to be described either by unitary and linear operators or anti-unitary and anti-linear operators. Now, anti-unitary and anti-linear operators are not connected to the identity operator, whereas we want our operators to be smoothly connected to the identity. That's why we choose to work with unitary and linear operators. And this is a similar reason as to why we choose to work with things that have determinant plus one instead of determinant minus one. So the simplest and most common SUN group is SU2. Well, there is U1, of course, but that is even more trivial. So SU2 is a group of 2x2 complex unitary matrices with determinant plus one. The most general SU2 matrix can actually be written as AB minus B star A star, where A and B are complex parameters. That have to satisfy A squared plus B squared equal to one. This will be one of the exercises in today's tutorial to show that this is the most general form that an SU2 matrix can take. So for now, you can believe me, and then you can show it in the tutorial. Okay. There is a theorem whose proof I cannot tell you right now that tells us that this is the choice that we have to make in quantum mechanics, in quantum field theory. So this is a theorem by Wigner. I can tell you more about this either in the tutorial today or next week if you're interested. Okay, so let's keep studying SU2 a little bit more. Oh, one thing we can see straight from here is if we express these two complex parameters as, let's say I choose to write A as x plus iy and B is u plus iv, then this relation becomes x squared plus y squared plus u squared plus v squared is 1, where x, y, u, and v are real parameters here. So if you imagine that x, y, u, and v are coordinates in a four-dimensional space, let's say in a four-dimensional Euclidean space, what does this equation describe? So if I have a vector x, y, u, v, this would be the distance of the vector from the origin or the length of the vector. And this equation tells me that the length of this vector has to be 1. So the set of these vectors forms a sphere in my four-dimensional space. So this is a three-dimensional sphere embedded in four-dimensional Euclidean space. And this is why we say that SU2 has the topology of S3. Yes, Tanya.
This group also has monotonic quaternions. Since the quaternions are the group on the free sphere?
I guess so. And it would be interesting to check that on Monday when we will actually be studying the algebra of quaternions. Okay, SU2 matrices act on vectors in that way. How do they act on operators? In other words, if we know that the vector, some vector chi is related to some other vector psi through a relation like this, where x is any operator, then if I want to write that after having performed a transformation, a unitary transformation, then chi goes to chi prime and psi goes to psi prime and this operator goes to x prime, what is the relation between x prime and x? Well, I know that chi prime is u acting on chi. I'm going to keep chi x prime here. And psi prime is just u acting on psi. Now I can multiply this relation by u dagger on both sides. And then what I have here is the identity operator. So the left-hand side just gives me back my vector chi. Whereas on this side, I have u tiger x prime u psi. I actually did it in the opposite way from what I was planning to do, but still the same thing. So now if I compare expressions 1 and 2, I see that the relation between x and x prime has to be x equals u dagger x prime u. And since u is a unitary operator, it's easy to invert this and write x prime equals ux u dagger. So this is the way that SU2 acts on operators. And one of the reasons I wanted to show this to you is because now I'm going to study a relation between SU2 and SO3, and I will be using that. So questions up to here. Yes. Yes, it is applicable for SUN as well. That's, yes, you're right. Everything, so this is applicable for SUN. Of course, this is just SU2. This is true for SUN, yes.
When we have an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, is there like an SU infinite? I mean, is there a rotation for, because we often have an infinite dimensional.
You can also think of infinite dimensional unitary operators, yes.
Yeah, so how come we are talking specifically about SU2 in the context of Hilbert space?
Okay, just because SU2 is after U1, it is the simplest case you can think of, and you come across it very often. This is spin operators are described by SU2. It is the simplest Lie group. And I actually now want to show that there is a homomorphism between SU2 and SO3. So we could also study SU3, for example, but since we only have a limited time to do some review, I just decided to do some simple SU2.
What do you mean by 3D sphere in a 4D space?
Okay.
How is it not a 4D sphere in a 4D space?
How is it, sorry?
Not a 4D sphere in a 4D space.
A 4D sphere cannot be embedded in a 4D space.
Okay,
so any... Yeah. In our three-dimensional space, we can think of two-dimensional spheres.
Okay, yeah.
But you have always to embed it in one dimension higher. Okay, so to see that there is a homomorphism between these two groups, what I'm going to do is start from a 3 vector. So I'm going to consider a general vector on which SO3 operators act. And then I'm going to turn this into a 2x2 complex matrix. And then I'm going to consider the action of SU2 operators on that. So, let's turn X into 2x2 complex matrix. Let's assume that the coordinates of X are x1, x2, x3. And now let's define the matrix X to be the sum over I of these components Xi multiplying the Pauli matrices sigma I. So just for 1 minute, maybe you can look into your lecture notes and remind yourselves of what the Pauli matrices are. These are three complex 2x2 matrices. We do come across them very often. Along with the identity, they form a basis for the group SL2C. And I don't want to divert here, but maybe this a good time to also remind you that the group SL2C is the group of complex invertible 2x2 matrices. But this is just an aside. This is what we really want to do. So I hope this is clear to everyone. These are matrices, these are numbers. We multiply numbers by matrices, we add them, we get back one matrix X. Say we do the same thing with some other vector Y and we get a matrix Y. And now, we take the matrix product between X and Y. This dot here means matrix product. So I multiply X by Y. Let me write this out. This means I'm multiplying X I sigma I with y j sigma j. Do notice that in this expression, when I replaced x by x I sigma I and y by y j sigma j, I chose to change the name of the index here from y to j so that I don't have the same index repeated more than twice. And now, these things are numbers, which means that I can pull them out. The matrix multiplication is just between sigma I and sigma j. It's easier this way. So this is X I Y J sigma I sigma J. The summations over I and J are still here. And now if I take a trace of my new matrix X multiplying Y, this should be equal from this relation to x I y j times the trace of sigma I sigma j. again, if you look in your lecture notes, and I always forget this relation. You will see that one of the properties of the Pauli matrices is that the product between two is given by delta ij times the identity matrix plus I epsilon ijk sigma k. Let me say a couple of things about the notation here. Here I am, let's say I am defining lower and upper indices to be just raised and lowered by delta ij. So it doesn't really matter if I write sigma with an index up or an index down. I just personally like it better this way because when I'm summing over an index, I prefer to see one index down, one index up. But in this case, I don't have a strange metric raising and lowering my indices. Sigma 1 is the same as sigma 1 up, and so on. And now, how about this symbol, epsilon ijk? I guess you have seen it before. This is the completely anti-symmetric symbol in three dimensions, completely anti-symmetric tensor. It is defined so that epsilon of 1, 2, 3 is equal to plus 1. And then any odd permutation of these numbers gives me a minus 1. For example, epsilon 1, 3, 2 is minus 1. Any even permutation brings me one back to plus 1. Epsilon 3, 1, 2 is plus 1. Okay, why did I write this down? I wrote it down because I wanted to use it there. And if I go and calculate the trace of sigma I, sigma j from here, I get delta ij times the trace of the identity plus I epsilon ijk times the trace of sigma k. What is the trace of the identity? Louder. 2. Because here I'm working with 2x2 complex matrices, right? This is the identity in that space. It's just 1, 0, 0, 1. So this is 2 times delta ij. And another property of the Pauli matrices is that they are all traceless. So this is actually 0. So this trace is just 2 times delta ij. So continuing from here, I can now write that the trace of the product of the two matrices X and Y is equal to 2 times delta ij xi yj. And now I can recognize this as the scalar product between the two vectors X and Y. This is 2 times scalar product between vector x and vector y. This is the scalar product between two vectors. Okay, why is this useful at all? We know that rotations preserve this scalar product. And we'll see now that SU2 transformations preserve this trace. Let's first see that. Say we do an SU2 transformation so that x goes to x prime. Y goes to u prime, to y prime. Then the trace of this matrix product goes to the trace of x, y, x prime dot y prime, which is equal to the trace between, yes, this is a Y. Thank you. So I can write this as U X. Sorry for my brackets are going to be confusing here. So this is the matrix UX multiplying the matrix UY. And one more thing I can do is, oh, I'm really sorry. This is why this doesn't work. Sorry, this is wrong. I should have used the relation that I derived up there. Too high for me to reach, which says that matrices transform like this. X prime is UX, U dagger, and Y prime is UY, U dagger. Because now X and Y are my complex matrices. They are supposed to be my operators in Hilbert space. So this is UX, U dagger multiplying UY, U dagger. And now U dagger U is equal to 1. This is the trace of U X Y U dagger. And if I use the cyclic properties of the trace, I'm sorry, I know that people cannot see here. I will rewrite this. If I use the cyclic properties of the trace, I see that this is just the trace of x dot y. So what I wanted to see here, okay, so what I was saying is that under an SU2 transformation, if x goes to x prime and y goes to y prime, the trace of the matrix product is conserved. But I did show that this trace is related to the scalar product between the two vectors I started from. So I see that there must be an SO3 transformation, an equivalent SO3 transformations that changes x to x prime in this way. Or in other words, if I start from a vector x, and from this I construct a matrix X, and then I act on this with an SU2 operator, and I get a new matrix X prime, and then I go back and find what the vector X prime is that would give me this matrix X prime, then this is equivalent to just doing an SO3 transformation from the vector X to the vector X prime.
Can you just pair like sigma X with the rotation operator Rx and change the
matrix
product to cross product?
Maybe not. It's actually not that easy. Again, I don't want to write it here because it's a big thing, but in the tutorial today you will see exactly what the form of an SO3 operator corresponding to a specific SU2 transformation is. You're saying so these are rotations or SU2 transformations? What are they? Okay, so you're saying, if I and then how do I relate the cross product to my rotation? It might work, but it's not easy for me to see it right now. If you see that it works, maybe you can write it down and share it with everyone. I don't know, does anyone else have something to say about this? Or questions about this and that? Okay. This tells us that there is a homomorphism between the two groups. It's actually not an isomorphism because how can I see this? Just wait a second. So this is a homomorphism. but not an isomorphism. If I change u to minus u, I actually get the same SO3 transformation. Where did that color chalk go? It doesn't really matter. If here I was using minus u instead of u, x prime would actually be the same, and y prime would also be the same. So it would still give me the original. The vectors would still remain the same. Again, this is something that in more detail you will see in your tutorial. I will give you the exact mapping between an SU2 and an SO3 operator, and you will see that we have this relation. So we say that SU2 is a double cover of SO3 because two SU2 operators, U and minus U, correspond to the same SO3 operator. And we write this as SO3 is isomorphic to SU2 over Z2, where Z2 is a group that just includes 1 and minus 1. Yes.
Do you mind giving me parts for that? What I was expecting based on the outline of what we were going to do was start off as we actually did with the 3x1 x vector converted into a matrix and operate on it by
SU2.
Yeah, and then convert back to SO3. So the way that the multiplication actually by y and this would be a trace and showing that that's a scalar product.
So one of the things we showed yesterday was that any transformation acting on three vectors that preserves the scalar product between any two three vectors has to be an O3 SO3, since we are working with determinant plus one here. So anything that preserves the scalar product is an SO3. So what we did here was we showed that the scalar product is preserved, and therefore whatever the transformation between x and x prime is, it has to be an SO3 transformation.
Every transformation in that space on 3x1 real vectors, it's that is equivalent to operation by SO3, right? That preserves scalar products.
So an SO3 transformation is a transformation that preserves the metric. And I thought we said this yesterday, but maybe I forgot to say it. It is that is equivalent to saying that the scalar product is preserved. Let's see this very quickly. We wrote scalar product like this, xi delta ij yj. And we said rotations or SO3 transformations have to preserve this metric. If I'm going from xi to rij xj, then if this matrix is an element of SO3, it has to satisfy rij delta ik rkl is equal to delta IL. No, delta JL. Now, what if the scalar product is preserved? This would mean that x prime dot y prime has to be equal to x scalar product y. And now this is x prime I delta ij y prime j. I'm just expanding the left-hand side here. A transformation by R takes this to R I K X K delta I J R J L Y L. And if I demand this to be the same as x dot y, I am demanding this to be the same as xk delta kl yl. Which means that this matrix product has to be equal to delta KL. And if you change the dummy indices a little bit, I can easily do it here. Well, not that easily. I want this to be J, I had a K to where did my, this has to be K. J, K, yes. The two relations are exactly the same. So anything that preserves the metric is exactly the same as something preserving the scalar product. Yes, of vectors in R3. Our vector space is a set of vectors in R3. Yes. Yes. Oh, why I put the double line? No, there is no special reason. I can erase it. And now I can talk about SO3,1. That's the group of Lorentz transformations, or as I had written it in the beginning, the group of rotations in Minkowski space. And oh, maybe I shouldn't have erased this. Is this okay? I'll stop here. Yes.
So there's no vector corresponding to the identity?
Wait a second. So if I take the zero vector, if I take an identity matrix and I do an SU2 transformation, the identity will remain the identity. So if I associate the identity with the zero vector, and I do any SU2 transformation here, this remains the identity. And indeed, the only vector that is unchanged under any kind of rotation is the zero vector, the origin.
There is no identity. Well, if you take the zero vector, you get the zero vector.
Oh, okay. I see what. So you would like to see another vector here, so that this is really the identity. Give me one second.
So are we left three interfaces matrices? So the identity matrix is in the image.
Say it again, sorry.
So we're taking vectors in R3 into the
I just found it out that there's no identity matrix, even though we're looking at SU2.
Because I also got confused on this. So the identity, if I want to look at the identity operator in SU2 and the identity operator in SO3, I have to choose my U here to be the identity. For any vector, X is whatever vector, X vector is whatever, and matrix X is whatever in the same way, is any complex 2x2 matrix. But now I want to study the identity in SU2. Then X prime is the same as X, which means that the vector X prime is also the same as the vector X, which means that the corresponding SO3 transformation is again the identity.
I think what you're saying is that you can't construct the identity matrix from that map. That, you know, you can make some matrix out of the poly matrices, right?
But it won't be the identity.
But you can't construct, that's what you're saying.
Yes, okay, but this is just I don't need to, though. I mean, this is some mapping, yeah, but I don't need to. I'm not saying that this gives me the whole SL2C group. This is just a trick I'm doing. SL2C. Because I have taken the identity out. So I cannot build the identity there, but these are not the operators that I'm studying. These are things that my operators act on. But this is something different. This is not what we are doing here. I mean, exponentiating the Pauli matrices, yes, generates SU2 transformations, but this is not what we are doing here. I lost my notes. Okay, so I will try to combine the study of Lorentz transformations and the Poincaré group with a very short introduction to review of special relativity. So I have already mentioned the words Minkowski spacetime. This is a four-dimensional spacetime. And every point in this spacetime is what we call an event in special relativity. It is, as I said, a point, a moment in this space-time, characterized, let's say, by coordinates t, x, y, and z. So we're treating time here as just one more coordinate. We define a space-time interval between two events, t, x, y, z, and so this is one event, the other event is t plus delta t, x plus delta x, y plus delta y. plus delta z. We define this to be, we call this delta s squared, and this is minus c, where c is the speed of light, delta t squared, plus delta x squared, plus delta y squared, plus delta z squared. And now Einstein told us in his theory of special relativity that this is the correct invariant quantity in this spacetime. If I move from one inertial frame to another inertial frame, I will see these coordinates changing, but what will remain invariant is the distance between two events defined in this way. And now what I'm going to do next, of course, is I'm going to set c equal to 1 and never write it again. I can write delta s squared as delta x mu eta mu nu delta x nu if I use the following conventions. I call the components of my vectors x mu, with mu taking values 0, 1, 2, and 3. And I define eta mu nu to be a matrix with entries minus 1, 1, 1, and 1 on the diagonal, and 0 everywhere else. And this is the Minkowski metric. Minkowski. Again, the summation rule over the indices is implied. Mu and mu are being summed over. Nu and nu are being summed over. And the most common conventions in relativity are that the index mu is used to describe any space-time index, time, or spatial coordinates. And we use Latin letters, such as I, to denote spatial coordinates. Greek letters for space-time, Latin letters for anything else. In other words, I can also write that x mu is x0 and xi. Okay, so Einstein told us that delta S squared has to remain invariant under transformations. So what kind of transformations do we allow so that this thing stays invariant? So what is the most obvious transformation that leaves the distance between two points invariant, where the distance is translations. Someone said Lorentz, but I think that translations is more obvious. So by translations, we mean that the coordinates of a vector, this is a mu, change in this way. From x mu, we go to x prime mu, which is equal to x mu plus some constant a mu. Since mu takes four values, this is actually a set of four constants. And I can also do rotations. I'm saying rotations because this will be rotations between space and time as well, so we will distinguish between them eventually. So just as we did with usual rotations, we are assuming here that the coordinates x mu are being multiplied by some matrix that here we call lambda. And in the same way as we did for rotations, we use one index up and one index down for those matrices. So to save some time, I won't do the same thing that I did for rotations before. But I think you can easily see that if rotations do leave that distance invariant, then they have to satisfy this equation. This is the property that the matrix lambda has to satisfy so that it leaves delta S squared invariant. Or if you want to write it in simpler matrix notation, this would be lambda transpose times eta times lambda is equal to lambda. So what I'm demanding here is that these matrices preserve the Minkowski matrix. I guess this meant that lambda is just eta. They preserve the Minkowski metric. And to be more correct, we call these things Lorentz transformations. And we see that they have to preserve the Minkowski metric. The group of these matrices is called the Lorentz group. And if we consider both translations and Lorentz transformations, then we are dealing with the Poincaré group. more do I have time to say? Okay, I'll take 5 more minutes. So one thing you will do in the tutorial today, one other thing you will do is you will actually check that the set of Lorentz matrices forms a group. And you will also check that Poincaré transformations also form a group. And in your tutorial, we will be using this notation for a general Poincaré transformation. So any Poincaré transformation should be described by a Lorentz matrix lambda plus a constant vector A for translations, so that the Poincaré group is a product of O3, 1 times R3. Right? This is for, so O3, 1 is the Lorentz group, and we write it like this because O3 meant rotations in 3-dimensional space. Now, we just want to distinguish, this is 4 dimensions, but one of these dimensions has signature -1 in the metric. So these are the transformations that preserve that metric and not a 4-dimensional metric with plus ones everywhere. So you will check that this is, yes. Sorry, yes, this is R4. Thank you. Sorry. And now we might want to study a special subgroup of the Lorentz group that has the following properties. The determinant of the transformations is +1. And the entry in the 0, 0 position of the Lorentz matrices is greater or equal to 1. These are, again, the transformations that can be connected to the identity. And this is called the proper orthochronous group. And we write, we denote this group by SO plus 3, 1. So S for the determinant being +1, the plus symbol here for this choice, and the full Lorentz group is a product of this one. Times inversions in space, which are described by the parity operator, times time inversions. This is the full Lorentz group. I will have to stop here. I don't really have time to start saying something else. But maybe we have 5 more minutes for questions. Yes.
Should it be larger than what, 0?
I think the convention is that it's...
So, why the plus if it doesn't mean positive?
Okay, I need to check this. I'll tell you in the tutorial. In my notes, I've written greater or equal to 1. It's usually... It means that it preserves the direction of time. If you want me to also do a lesson in Greek, I would say that this means proper time.
And every time I've seen the concrete structure, it's always been like a semi-direct part between the space translations and the Lorentz group.
Huh. You might be right. And that's...
That would be right, because the Euclidean group, which is just translation of cross-rotation, is in 3 dimensions.
Okay, so thank you for that comment.
I haven't done this before, but I'm not sure why you denote the Lorentz group as O3,
comma 1. So if I wanted to describe rotations in a Euclidean 4-dimensional space, so just a generalization of what I was doing before in O3, I would write this as O4. So O4 would be the set of matrices that, in that notation, preserve a Euclidean metric. Yes, so this would just be the identity matrix with ones everywhere. Now, in Minkowski space-time, we know, because we know that the thing that stays invariant is this quantity, we know that our metric needs to have different signs between time and space. So the metric that we want to preserve is not 1, 1, 1, 1, but has a -1 here. And just to distinguish that we have 3 entries in our metric with a positive signature and 1 entry with a negative signature, we write this as O3, 1. You might also see it as O1, 3. It just means that there are 3 signatures that are +/-1 and 1 signature that is the opposite.
Tell us anything about the relationships between the works of the people,
Minkowski,
Einstein, and Lorentz, because the 3 names keep coming up, so much I'd like to be able to distinguish how they relate.
No, I cannot, because I am not sure who came first. Einstein definitely was the last one, but...
I think Lorentz was before Einstein, and Minkowski was after Einstein.
Really?
I'm
sure that that's a question that Wikipedia...
Minkowski did this.
Okay,
yeah, I mean, pertaining to special roles.
Lorentz was
a quarantine. That's what's my question.